sister just had to spill some liquor. A new rapper asked about new rappers. I don't feel the niggas. I chill with women, they chill with niggas. They different. They in the field so long, these Timberlands made a killing in them. I benefited from plenty hitters, they steal my niggas. When Master P was yelling ice cream man, uncle got caught with 19 grams. If you don't like me, damn. How you gon' hate me? I ain't have in the refrigerator. Nas royal silk from molded bread and spoiled milk. I know they gon' hate y'all. I know they gon' hate y'all. I know they gon' hate y'all. The time it took me to make it here. Tell me how the fuck I'ma make it fair for a hater. I know these niggas ain't playing fair. Murder let you know that it's real and we can take it there. Couldn't afford them Jordans, had to take a pair. I done seen the toughest niggas freeze up. Hammer just left them shaking there. This feel like a lion trying to race a bear. You niggas will never catch me, it's probably gonna take a year. Top 10, I'm locked in, like Jamaican hair. Headshots, it used to be a scope, I put a laser there. Put newspaper on the carpet here, who walking? I don't trust these voices talking, nor the walls in my apartment. It's getting darker, pistol under the parka. Imagine pouring fruity pebbles and roaches fall out. Make you wanna go to court, shoot the judge before you walk out. Make you wanna eat it, the food, just pull a fork out. I'll be doing push-ups in my cell before I talk about anything we involved in. Criminal code, ex just ready for war. They some militant, coke in the flesh. This that you feel in your nose. You college niggas come see how it feel to chill with a bro. Could never compare, you don't know how it feel to be broke. Just trying to get high, dish you feet and still in your smoke. Could never punch her, but when I fuck her, she still could get choked. First verse, what's the struggle? I bubble right off an eight ball. Eight ball with all black diamonds, I bet they hate y'all. That money. No, they gon' hate y'all. They gon' hate y'all.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live, WBAI.org. And as soon as we work out a small technical issue, we will be listening to Health Action with Bob Lederer this evening. Please stand by.
Thank you. Bob Lederer, welcome to Health Action. In today's program, we will spend the entire hour looking at the remarkable life of Dr. Marie Equi.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid of the goons and inks and company freaks and deputy sheriffs who made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called, and when the company boys came round, she always stood her ground. You can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
This is Bob Lederer. We're going to have the first of a two-part series in which we'll be discussing the remarkable life of Dr. Marie Equi, who lived from 1872 to 1952. Equi was a lesbian physician and political activist, primarily based in Portland, Oregon, who was devoted to providing care to working class and poor patients, providing reproductive health care information to women, and fighting initially for civic and economic reforms, women's right to vote, and an 8-hour workday, and later for a socialist society as part of the Anarchist Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW. Due to her strident public opposition to World War I, which she denounced as an imperialist venture, she served 10 months in federal prison on charges of violating the Sedition Act passed at the behest of President Woodrow Wilson. Equi was also remarkably open about her intimate relationships with women in an era when doing so was extremely rare and stigma and persecution against lesbians and gay men was extreme. Yet despite Equi's groundbreaking achievements, she remains almost totally unknown today, both to the LGBTQ community and to the left. Later this year, in San Francisco's iconic gay neighborhood, the Castro, Equi will receive her own bronze commemorative plaque on the Rainbow Honor Walk commemorating the achievements of noted LGBT persons throughout history. In 2015, the first full-length biography of Equi was published, titled Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. It was written by Michael Hellquist and published by Oregon State University Press. Michael is a writer and historian who has worked in the anti-war, HIV/AIDS, and LGBTQ movements since the 1970s. He has published widely in LGBTQ and mainstream publications. His biography of Equi was named a 2016 Stonewall Honor Book. We're speaking with him from San Francisco, where he lives with his husband. And Michael, thank you so much for coming on WBAI.
I'm happy to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Well, first I'd like to ask you, how did you choose to write about Marie Equi, and what was it about her that led you to commit so much time and effort to tell her story, and actually, how did you even first hear about her?
Well, I was intrigued with Marie Equi ever since I read on a website based in the Pacific Northwest about her publicly horsewhipping a Baptist minister in the center of a small Oregon town in 1893. She was 20 years old, she was new to town, and she was living with her schoolteacher girlfriend. Something about this image of this slight girl of 20, or woman of 20, who decided to defend her girlfriend's honor by taking a horsewhip to the school superintendent, who was also a Baptist minister, really grabbed my attention, and I wanted to know more. And then further, with a little bit more reading and further research, I was really taken with Equi as a woman of such compassion and conviction, and she had such a drive for independence and a commitment to help the underdog throughout her life. So that really drew me in, but I also wanted to contribute to lesbian gay history, and as well as to radical and political history in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the West especially. And as far as the lesbian gay angle, we know very little LGBT history in that region of the country before, say, up to World War II. So I wanted to make a contribution in that way. And finally, I was really attracted to Ekwe because most of her life she was an outsider, and she was from a working class family in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Her parents were immigrants. She was had to drop out of high school to help support the family, and then self-taught her way into medical school. All these things really intrigued me about how she dealt with the obstacles that she felt, how she struggled with feeling not part of the mainstream, partly because I and so many other people have felt outsiders and struggle with some of the same issues that she did. So several of those factors really drew me in.
Okay, well, I think her struggle with being outside the mainstream is a great starting point to talk about her political trajectory throughout life. And so let's start with the early period when she first got active as a progressive. At that time, the Progressive Party, so that's capital P Progressive, that was active in reform, particularly at the state levels around a lot of issues of corporate abuses and electoral corruption and many other issues, and also women's right to vote, and then evolved over time to become a revolutionary who joined the Industrial Workers of the World and was even deemed queen of the Bolsheviks. So tell us about how she went from her working class upbringing and the deprivations of that period to then being able to go to med school, become a doctor, and then from there her political changes she went through.
Okay. Well, I wanted to preface that briefly talking about her upbringing in New Bedford. Her father and her brothers were involved in the Knights of Labor union movement, and she was very much aware of strikes that occurred in New Bedford. Her father worked as a stonemason. He wasn't in one of the other unions for the craft. And so she was exposed to that. She would talk about her father would bring strikers home to share their meals when they didn't have enough to eat themselves. So she really got some orientation to the struggles of working class people. And then she also realized that she had to find a place for herself in the world, since she knew she didn't want to get married, that she was attracted to other women, and she needed to create a life of her own. So she became a doctor, one of the first women doctors along the West Coast in 1903. And once she was established, she became more involved with, as you were saying, the progressive civic reform movement of the day, which was particularly strong on the West Coast. And she was involved in several of the women's suffrage campaigns in Oregon. It took several to even achieve women's suffrage, but Ekwe was involved, and she had this stature. Now that she was a woman professional, she was a physician. So she really leveraged her status to have as much impact as she could for the benefit of the cause. She worked on women's suffrage steadily. She worked for an 8-hour workday on the state level, even with changes in the state government and whatever advocacy avenues were available to her then. She advocated greater market safety, meaning in the public markets in Portland. And just the range of civic reform, and this was, at this time, Oregon was a leader in the initiative and referendum movement and those kinds of governmental actions that we're so familiar with today. She continued with that activity until 1913, the summer of 1913, when she became radicalized in her first clash with police. And maybe we could pick up some further information about that strike, and then I can address more of what happened afterwards in her political development, if that works.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead and read this wonderfully evocative passage of your book where you capture that moment out on the street fighting for the rights of the canning workers who were on strike in 1913 in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Just a little setup. The women were striking that were cannery workers in Portland. Equi had joined the strike. It was gaining more attention. The governor of the state intervened and called a special meeting of strikers to be held in Portland City Hall, and Equi went. She was not a leader at the time. She was simply someone of stature who had joined the strike. In this hothouse setting, Equi thrust herself into the center of attention. She stood on a chair and proclaimed her readiness to, quote, shed her blood on the pickup line. She rolled up her sleeve to expose the large bruise from a policeman's club during an earlier street tussle. The newspapers latched onto Equi as the occasion's dramatic figure with her passionate, theatrical defense of the women. Thereafter, she became the public face of the strike. According to one Portland newspaper, hundreds of people paid attention to the dispute once Equi mounted the soapbox. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and two San Francisco dailies followed suit and declared Equi the strike leader. After that meeting, and with street protests staged every night, the edgy tension and resentment between the deputies and the strikers festered. 3 days after the meeting with the governor, the deputies arrested a string of strikers. First, socialist Tom Burns was pulled from the soapbox. The highly critical dailies claimed he had predicted that the red flag of anarchy would soon fly over the courthouse. Then eight others were picked off one by one from the box, all on the charge of using profane language. One of the speakers dragged away was Agnes O'Connor, a 30-year-old pregnant Native American. Equi witnessed the arrest and erupted in rage. She later told a reporter, "All the fighting Irish blood and the fighting Italian blood rose in my heart." Whatever blows Equi may have landed, the officers clubbed her with enough force to leave bruises. In full fury, Equi rallied the crowd to follow the police to the station and demand the release of all the strikers. Newspapers reported that Equi punched two officers in the face during a struggle at the jail. The sheriff relented and released O'Connor, but detained the others. 2 nights later, Equi and other women strikers attempted a protest at a downtown intersection the mayor told strikers to avoid. The day had steamed at 94 degrees, and more than 3,000 people crowded on the street and sidewalks to hear the women. Before Equi or anyone else could start, a massive show of force disrupted the gathering. Police cavalry charged the street, horses bucked and kicked, knocking people down. For 30 minutes, police marched back and forth, clearing people away and clubbing dozens. 18 were arrested, including Equi. The county sheriff himself arrested her. She cursed him loudly and later recalled, "They threatened to split our heads open." On the way to the jail, Equi stabbed a patrolman with a hat pin, according to one report. She had previously threatened to kill anyone who tried to keep her from speaking with a virus-dipped pin that would cause a slow, lingering death. In her mind, it was a matter of free speech and not being told what she couldn't do. The officer cauterized his wound immediately and suffered no greater damage. Thereafter, the sensational hatpin assault, accurate or not, enhanced Equi's reputation, with even the New York Times describing the incident. The Portland police had seldom dealt with a woman like Equi, who yelled, cursed, fought, kicked, threatened officers' lives, and refused to back down. Obstreperous women had certainly resisted arrest before, but few, if any, held her professional status, her standing in the community, and commitment to a cause. She faced criminal charges for disorderly conduct and inciting a riot. Bail was set at $500, and the authorities threatened her with prison or confinement in a mental institution. The Oregonian newspaper had already described her as, quote, dangerously insane. Equi advanced her own explanation for why authorities tossed the insanity charge her way. Quote, it was beyond the imagination of these people who repeatedly attacked me that a professional woman of established practice and reputation, of some money and high standing in the community, could put these aside and get out and work for her unfortunate sisters and brothers. Therefore, I must be insane. Equi also charged that the police subjected her to rough third-degree treatment at the jail. What I underwent, I can't tell you, she said. I am too much of a woman to go into the detail of it. 3 hours of torture during which my womanhood revolted. And every now and then they asked if I would now go to California. Then they took me to a woman's cell and threw me in. The interrogation by officers and the curtailment of her free speech jolted Equi for far more than she expected. At the police station, she declared, I started in this fight as a socialist, but now I am an anarchist. I'm going to speak where and when I wish. No man will stop me. For her, a line had been crossed. Her rights as a citizen had been trampled, and her fierce independence had been threatened.
I want to thank you, Michael, for that gripping excerpt from your book, Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. I think we all can vividly see that moment when she did become radicalized and embarked on a whole new path in her political activism. And we will pick up that trail in part two of this program, but we're going to return to Marie Equi's political trajectory in part two of this program, but now I want to turn to who she was as a person. And you write that Equi was one of the first women, if not the first, to be publicly known as a lesbian on the West Coast. She was also one of the first lesbians to ever be granted a court-approved adoption of a child. So talk about how she dealt with her sexuality publicly, the attacks that she endured, and her legacy in LGBTQ history. Now, you've mentioned a couple of the lesbian relationships that Marie Equi had during her life, and these were just two among quite a few, with women that, in some cases, that she actually lived with for a long time or had other types of intimate relationships with, and more often than not, they were with fellow or sister radical activists. So talk to us about some of those that you've been able to uncover.
Well, in private correspondence with a friend, Equi once perhaps boasted that she had once loved 10 famous women, and we don't know who all the 10 were. But probably the two that were most important and the one more aligned with her own philosophy and politics were Margaret Sanger, the birth control advocate, and who was nationally known at the time, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a very prominent member of the Industrial Workers of the World, the radical union that was involved in labor rights in the early 1900s especially. And with Margaret Sanger, they got to know each other when Sanger was on a tour of Portland, and they even ended up in jail together for distributing birth control information, pamphlets. And there are letters that have been obtained where Equi boldly states her passionate love for Sanger and holding her and caressing her. So we're clear that was one of the objects of her love for another woman. Margaret Sanger reciprocated to some degree that's not quite as clear. And then there's Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was very prominent with the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a one big union radical movement. And she and Ecuy got to know each other through their similar affiliations and their political beliefs and being in protest together. And at one point, Ecuy was providing medical care, taking care of Gurley Flynn in Portland. And that extended for some time because Gurley Flynn was quite ill and she stayed at Marie Ecuy's home and a relationship deepened. And it's not clear the exact nature of their relationship. There were certainly very strong feelings of regard and care for each other. There's no definitive statement that they had a lesbian relationship, if you're trying to define it that way. At one point, someone who was also in the house at the time said that she happened upon Ecuy and Gurley Flynn sharing a bed in the bedroom. So, but I think the important thing is the emotional connection that was happening, and that relationship continued for about 9 years back and forth with Gurley Flynn living with Ecuy, sometimes going to New York and then returning. So that was a very important, pivotal time for her. And I think Ecuy was a great support. This was time during the Depression when Gurley Flynn had few resources, and Ecuy really stepped up and helped her get through that time period. So those were the two most famous ones. And it partly shows the kind of woman that Ecuy was attracted to, who she was involved with, and also emphasizes this circle of professional women who really looked after each other and helped each other and cared for each other. I think that was what was most important to Ecuy.
And just as an interesting footnote about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, she went on to become very active in the U.S. Communist Party, for which then she became one of the hundreds who were attacked in the McCarthy period by the U.S. government and was charged and convicted with conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government and serve several years in federal prison in the 1950s. They shared that commonality, even though that happened after Marie Ecuy died in 1952.
Well, let me say they shared that radical fervor in general, but Ecuy was definitely not a communist, and she actually seemed to break with Gurley Flynn later when Flynn became more involved in the Communist Party. She was very upset about that, and they really were not able to resolve that issue, and for all intents and purposes, their relationship, even as colleagues, ended.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there for now. This is part one of a two-part series about the life of Dr. Marie Ecuy. And stay tuned for part two. And I want to thank our guest, Michael Hellquist, LGBTQ historian and author of the book Marie Ecuy, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions, who's joined us from San Francisco. And you can learn more about Michael and his writing at www.michaelhellquist, that's H-E-L-Q-U-I-S-T, michaelhellquist.com. And I also want to thank our engineer, John Riley.
Thanks very much.
Because we remember Lynn Stewart, the late great people's lawyer, we will always organize to free U.S. political prisoners. We also recall that Dick Gregory fasted to free Lynn from her unjust imprisonment. This is Ralph Pointer. On October 6th, please join me, Assemblyman Charles Barron, Black freedom fighter Sekou Odinga, and many other activists, BAI hosts, musicians, and poets, as we celebrate Lynn's legacy and address the task ahead in winning freedom for political prisoners. We'll also show a documentary in progress about Lynn's life. That's Friday, October 6th from 6:30 to 10 p.m. at Theater 80, St. Mark's, on St. Mark's Place between 1st and 2nd Avenues in Manhattan. For more information, go to lynnstewart.org or call 917-853-9759. That's 917-853-9759.
And we'll return for part two of my interview with Michael Hellquist, author of Marie Ecuy, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions, after this break. Stay tuned. WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. This is Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer. And now part two of our program.
This union maid was wise to the tricks of company spies. She couldn't be fooled by company stools. She always got her way when she struck for higher pay. She'd show her card to the company guard, and this is what she'd say: "Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
This is Bob Lederer. This is the second part of a two-part series on the remarkable life of Dr. Marie Equi, who lived from 1872 to 1952. Equi was a lesbian physician and political activist, primarily based in Portland, Oregon, who was devoted to providing care to working-class and poor patients, providing reproductive health care information to women, and fighting initially for civic and economic reforms, women's right to vote, and an eight-hour workday, and later for a socialist society as part of the Anarchist Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW. Due to her strident public opposition to World War I, she served 10 months in federal prison on charges of violating the Sedition Act, which had been passed at the behest of President Woodrow Wilson. Equi was also remarkably open about her intimate relationships with women in an era where doing so was extremely rare and stigma and persecution against lesbians and gay men was strong. And we explored some of those aspects of her life in part one. Yet, despite Equi's groundbreaking achievements, she remains almost totally unknown both to the LGBTQ community and the left. In 2015, the first full-length biography of Equi was published, titled Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. It was written by Michael Hellquist and published by Oregon State University Press. Michael is a writer and historian who's worked in the anti-war, HIV/AIDS, and LGBTQ movements since the 1970s. He's published widely in LGBTQ and mainstream publications, and his biography of Equi was named a 2016 Stonewall Honor Book. And we're speaking to him from San Francisco, and thanks again for coming on WBAI, Michael.
You're very welcome, and I'm happy to be here.
Okay. So for those who missed part one of our interview, can you give us a very brief summary of kind of the arc of Dr. Marie Equi's activist work?
Sure. This is a woman who was from a working class background. She actually, as a child, was working in textile mills of New Bedford, Massachusetts. But she was seeking independence, and she self-taught her way into medical school, which was a remarkable accomplishment at that time in the early 1900s. And once she got settled in her medical practice, she started getting involved with progressive reform movement. This was in Portland, Oregon, and the progressive civic reform movement was very strong in the state. So she was involved with women's suffrage and with improved working conditions, an 8-hour workday, and those kinds of reforms. And she became radicalized in 1913 when she joined a strike of women cannery workers. And that's really at that point where things turned for her. She was beaten up by police officers, and that shocked her and sort of jolted her out of thinking that the working within the system might be enough to take care of social issues. And it set her on a radical path that defined much of her later life.
And one of the nodal points in that later radical life was in 1917, which is this year is actually the 100th anniversary of the United States entering World War I. And at that time, there was a mass movement of militant opposition to U.S. involvement led by the Socialist Party and the Industrial Workers of the World. They viewed this war as merely a battle for dominance among imperialist powers. In response to this upsurge, President Wilson got Congress to pass the Sedition Act, which made it a felony to speak, write, or publish any, quote, disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language, unquote, about the government, the armed forces, the flag, the draft, the war industries, or the liberty bonds, which was a major tool for getting citizen investment in the war effort. So, Michael Hellquist, talk to us about the Justice Department's sweeping use of the Sedition Act against activists, then tell us how and why Marie Ecuy opposed the war, how she was ultimately prosecuted under that act and sentenced, and including with very explicit homophobic comments by the prosecutor during that case, and then ended up spending 10 months in federal prison after a worldwide campaign that got President Wilson to reduce what her original sentence was, which was 3 years.
Let's start with the preparedist movement, which you referred to just briefly, to say at that time, this was before the U.S. entered the war in 1917, many Americans were not supporting of the war. They had serious doubts about doing it, just didn't want to get engaged with Europe's problems. But they were persuaded by the federal government that it was best to at least be prepared in case war came about. Then, rather soon thereafter, war was declared. The U.S. did join World War I. And there was that a response which often happens in times of war. The citizenry will rise to the occasion, in a sense, and support the government, support the country, and that became the national the patriotic thing to do. But the government wasn't satisfied in leaving it at that. The government was in a position that they really were unprepared for war with military resources and for financing it. So they really needed to drum up support for the war effort as much as they could, and they needed to be sure that no one was dissuaded from supporting the war. So they passed this Sedition Act, trying to curb any dissent that occurred. First it was the Espionage Act that was passed, and that was to try to curtail more traditional sense of spying or undermining the military.
Which, incidentally, was the law used to, among others, to prosecute Chelsea Manning, the Army private who decided to disclose the Army videos and State Department correspondence that showed the violations of international law by the U.S. government.
Yes, that's right. At first, with the Espionage Act, the government thought that would be enough, but they found that there were vigilante groups, private citizens, that were, anytime they heard something disloyal, they would take out revenge, in a sense, for the person who was issuing those remarks. So partly the government wanted to go to another step to intervene because they were being criticized, the government, for not doing enough. So they passed the Sedition Act, which was so sweeping, as you mentioned, basically saying you cannot talk about anything against the government or anything it's doing and with the war. And they drummed up this really enormous war persuasion propaganda effort, which involved Liberty Loan type of campaigns to raise more money. But they also mobilized what became the FBI to spy on people. And they also encouraged individual citizens to report, spy on, and report their neighbors, who's been saying things casually or in small groups. And all of those reports got reported to government agents in each of the states, and many of them were pursued.
And in fact, you actually obtained from the Justice Department's files some of those surveillance reports on Marie Ecuy and the young and brand new director of the predecessor to the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, actually was personally quite obsessed by her case. Isn't that right?
Right. He did become obsessed as it worked up in the prosecution system. Once she was charged, and she was charged simply for giving a speech against the war. She wasn't involved in any effort to bomb buildings or to harm any individuals, but for a speech, she was charged with sedition. And during a long process of her leading up to her trial, the U.S. government had her under surveillance 24/7, and they interviewed her friends and colleagues, tried to get statements about her, about whether she was a reputable person or not. They assigned 8 agents to work on this one person in Portland. Finally, the trial came about, and Marie Ecuy was convicted. It was hardly a jury of her peers, the all-male jury, and mostly from small town Oregon. And during the trial, I think the government really tipped its hand when the federal prosecutor, after trying to outline all the dangerous things that Ecuy had said, he also referred to her as an unsexed woman. And he was clearly referencing to her bad moral standing and character, partly because she was providing abortions, but also because of her lesbianism, her relationships with other women. He was really trying to, and did, use that against her, really defamed her in the public, before the public eye, with those homophobic comments. Ecuy appealed repeatedly, and then she tried to draw out the process of her appeal as long as she could, because the thought was, once the war is ended, she would have and once people's sentiment got back to more normal times, she would get a better ruling, or maybe the case would be dismissed. That didn't happen, and she was sentenced to 3 years in San Quentin prison. President Wilson, at the last minute, commuted her sentence to 1 year and a day, and she was sent to San Quentin.
Now, we should say that wasn't any inspired act of humanitarianism on his part. That took a really determined, ultimately an international campaign by Ecuy and her supporters to pressure him to grant that commutation. Isn't that right?
Yes. She had many associates and friends in high positions, and many from the Pacific Northwest, but also many from New York and from other centers of political activity in the country, pleading with him, demanding that the president either pardon her, dismiss the case. And you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. The way he got involved was, once the president's office was getting more heat for this decision, he wanted to know how they should proceed. And even his assistants, meaning J. Edgar Hoover's assistants, suggested that the case not be pursued. But he overturned their advice, and he went ahead and wanted her to be convicted and sentenced, sent to prison. He believed what he was hearing by other prosecutors, that she had become one of the most dangerous radicals in the West Coast. So he had the chance there to show some leniency, and he adamantly refused to, and he continued to do so as she pursued trying to get out of prison earlier than her sentence. And he put down all those attempts.
But before that, I just wanted to go to another activity she engaged in during this same period, which is that she was one of the doctors, the few doctors at that time, who provided abortions when abortions were illegal, and she was jailed with Margaret Sanger, the noted women's reproductive rights activist, for distributing birth control information. So talk to us about that work that she did, and also about a more controversial aspect in today's understanding about Equies and Margaret Sanger's views on eugenics, which is the philosophy of restricting reproduction of people with quote-unquote undesirable traits, such as physical and mental disabilities that were claimed to be concentrated among poor, uneducated, and oppressed minority populations, and which was used to support legislation for forced sterilization of people in those groups, and later more fully adopted in horrendous form by the Nazis in Germany.
Right. Doctoring meant everything to Equi. She very much identified with being a physician and her medical background, and she increased her understanding as much as she could to be a better caretaker of her parent, of her patients. So in some ways, it's not surprising, given her independent streak and her sensibilities about challenges to the working class families, many of whom were her patients, that she quickly recognized the dilemma that women and sometimes their husbands and their whole families dealt with repeated pregnancies. She had seen it all around her as a child in New Bedford, and certainly as a doctor, she would have women coming to her begging for her assistance, that they were just no longer able physically or financially to have one more child. So she was a very determined advocate of birth control. At that time, distributing birth control information was illegal, and she nevertheless was able to get a hold of documents, pamphlets about birth control, and find ways to either distribute them directly to her patients or to help set up kind of a network where she could give copies to someone else who would distribute it in the neighborhood or to their friends.
And in fact, didn't she also help Margaret Sanger edit one of the information pamphlets about birth control?
She did. During Margaret Sanger's first national tour in 1916, she stopped in Portland, and she asked Marie's help, since she was a doctor, to revise her sort of basic document, which was called Family Limitation. It was a purse or pocket-sized little booklet, and Equi did revise that. And Equi also, interesting, geared it even more toward working-class people and those involved in labor unions, trying to reach out to those people in particular. So she continued in this work with Sanger during her visit, and this was the time that Sanger was arrested on her tour. It was the only city nationally where Sanger was arrested for distributing birth control information, and Equi was arrested with her along with three other women.
And the claim was that these materials were obscene, is that right?
Right, right. The prosecution sort of danced around what the situations were, saying, you know, this wouldn't be so bad if it was distributed maybe in a doctor's office or in a pharmacy or something like that, but we're scared that it might just be available for young, impressionable minds, and they would be exposed to things that they shouldn't hear about at this point. But basically, they wanted to shut down the operation, and Sanger and Equi and others had a march through Portland objecting to it. So that was a part of the birth control aspect, and she continued that throughout her life, or her active life as a doctor. And then at some point, we don't have an exact date, but sometime like between 1905 and 1915, ECWI began providing abortions to women who were requesting them. And this was illegal nationally and also in Portland, where she was at. And I think it came from her same sense of trying to help women who were having a hard time as it was, or who just really weren't ready, prepared to raise a child. And ECWI did go ahead and provide abortions. These were because of the times and because lots of women doctors didn't even have privileges at hospitals. The kind of abortions that she would do would be very early in the term, and such abortions were relatively low in risk, certainly if done in a doctor's office with sterile equipment, et cetera. So this just became part of what she did. Reproductive justice, as we think of it all today, was kind of second nature to her as being a good doctor and helping her patients. Of course, lots of other women doctors at the time made a distinction and would not do that, and some of them were mostly concerned, as they might be, about losing their medical licenses. ECWI went ahead and took the risk and provided the abortions. So you also asked about ECWI's involvement with Sanger and the birth control movement and how that interfaced with eugenics. So I think we need to recognize that eugenics was a relatively popular theory or belief at the time that was espoused by U.S. presidents and by prominent scientists and other people in public life. They didn't have the same connotations then as later developed, with the onset of World War II. And I don't have any evidence. I wasn't able to find any documentation that ECWI said anything about eugenics. She was involved with Planned Parenthood, but I think she was involved as far as we said, being part of the birth control distribution system and helping patients. And, you know, it's interesting with Sanger, who started out as a political radical whose mentor was Emma Goldman. You might say that Sanger was for abortion before she was against it. And what was happening, as best as I can tell after reading several of the biographies of Sanger, was that she was pushing a movement that was under siege. There was a lot of opposition to it. And she really felt this passion to reach as many people as she could. Well, with that passion, she made compromises along the way, unfortunate ones and damaging ones. She took on this cause of eugenics, I think, partly to be aligned with a more popular social movement, hoping that birth control would get the benefit of that association, that she would be able to reach more people. And she thought that she might also be able to get more funding for the operation, because they were always strapped for finances for getting the word out about birth control. So Margaret Sanger can definitely be faulted for those choices. She definitely damaged her legacy for many people. But I think it's important to keep a kind of nuanced appreciation for those times about this belief that we find abhorrent today and that many people did then too, but that others weren't quite as far along on that understanding, or they were outright bigots, racists, etc., that wanted eugenics for the horrible reasons that it got advanced. But I think it's also important to realize that much of the actual physical activity and harm in the implementation of eugenic policies, the forced sterilization, were mostly conducted, if not all conducted, by state institutions, federal institutions, and public organizations. Other people were more involved with the debate about it. And this is one of the instances in which I really wished that I had more verification of how ECWI felt on these matters. She obviously was aware of it, but that information is not available.
Well, in closing, Michael Hellquist, how do you think the life of Dr. Marie Equi is relevant today, both for people in general who are struggling for peace and social and economic justice, and in particular for LGBTQ activists?
Well, sometimes I tell people this about Equi, and it's kind of a recap, and I say, imagine someone on the front lines for a living wage, better working conditions, voting and reproductive rights, free speech, and an overhaul of the criminal justice system. Marie Equi did all that 100 years ago, and she was a lesbian, one of the first publicly known lesbians on the West Coast. So certainly for advocates, she was fighting for the issues that many of us are fighting for today. And I think it's instructive to see how she did it, how she dealt with the risks, as well as what benefits there were for her, how strongly she pursued that. And I think her resilience and the fact that she persisted is words that are so prominent for us today is very relevant. And for a more general readership, I think this is a story of a woman's struggle to define herself, to become independent, and to do what she thought was best to help others in need. And for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer people, you know, I think this is a profile in courage in many ways. Because she really stuck her neck out to go for what she wanted, to follow her dream in her life and to make it happen and to continue even with setbacks. And I think that's inspiring. And again, or they were outright bigots, racists, she was aware of it. Voting and reproductive rights, free speech, and an overhaul of the criminal justice system. Marie Equi did all that 100 years ago, and she was a lesbian, one of the first publicly known lesbians on the West Coast. So certainly for advocates, she was fighting for the issues that many of us are fighting for today. And I think it's instructive to see how she did it, how she dealt with the risks, as well as what benefits there were for her, how strongly she pursued that. And I think her resilience and the fact that she persisted is words that are so prominent for us today is very relevant. And for a more general readership, I think this is a story of a woman's struggle to define herself, to become independent, and to do what she thought was best to help others in need. And for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer people, you know, I think this is a profile in courage in many ways, because she really stuck her neck out to go for what she wanted, to follow her dream in her life and to make it happen and to continue even with setbacks. And I think that's inspiring. And again, the fact that she was an outsider in much of her life, even after she became a doctor, she wasn't fully accepted into the mainstream. I think that touches many of us who have felt or maybe still do feel to be outsiders in this community, this population today. And I think she's showing, you know, a really great example of how to proceed and how to endure.
Okay, well said. I want to thank our guest, Michael Hellquist, LGBTQ historian and author of the book Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. And you can learn more about Michael and his writing at the website www.michaelhellquist.com. That's H-E-L-Q-U-I-S-T, michaelhellquist.com. And also thanks to our intrepid engineer, John Riley.
This morning, works better with the mic turned on, doesn't it? This morning, our guest is Chandler Klein-Smith, but we'll have a movie review first, so stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The basic idea behind the auteur theory is that a movie's director is the author of his or her film. Every person who contributes to that film, actors, writers, cinematographers, composers, all the various technical posts, works to fulfill that vision. This is the theory, and unlike scientific theories, which are either proven or not proven in time, for artistic endeavors, there needs to be quite a bit of wiggle room. Animation in particular can be a serious test of the theory. The director puts his/her mark on visuals, but then the animators beneath him/her will take his/her initial drawings and flesh them out, ideally bringing personality and life to the movements. It raises serious questions of authorship. Did director Bob Clampett make Daffy Duck Daffy, or is that animator Rod Scribner's brilliant work? I tend to be orthodox about these things. I cleave to the idea that the director rules all. But things can happen that do make me question my stand sometimes. The first few minutes of Mary and the Witch's Flower, which opens theatrically this Friday, look for all the world like legendary anime director Hayao Miyazaki is running through a catalog of his greatest hits. There's a young girl's desperate escape from mysterious and ominous captors like Laputa, Castle in the Sky. There's a ravishing flight scene on a broomstick like Kiki's Delivery Service. And there's an attack by strange, pliable creatures like Spirited Away. But this is not Miyazaki. This is director Hiromasa Yonebayashi, whose previous directorial effort when Marnie was there also aped the look and storytelling style of Miyazaki's Studio Ghibli. And here's the point. Yonebayashi does not come by this miraculous emulation by accident. He contributed as animator to many Studio Ghibli films and even directed one, The Secret World of Arrietty, under the Studio Ghibli banner. And yet, if one didn't know Miyazaki hadn't directed Mary and the Witch's Flower, which is about a young girl who discovers both a blossom that bestows her magical powers and a broomstick that whisks her away to a school for witches where the headmasters are plotting an ominous fate for non-magic users. If you didn't know Miyazaki hadn't directed it, you'd be hard-pressed to make the distinction. And it goes beyond just the look. The broomstick flight sequences have the same joyous kineticism. The settings revel in the same kind of lush storybook detail. The characters emote with the same full-body conviction. Which raises the question, if this is Miyazaki without Miyazaki, where is the Miyazaki in actual Miyazaki? Where does the artistry of the animators end and the director actually begin? One answer may be in a certain soul that the Miyazaki films possess that Yonobayashi is still working towards. Miyazaki goes beyond technical visual excellence to an understanding of his characters and their motivations, imbuing them with a sense of life. Yonobayashi's When Marnie Was There, for instance, felt a little too much like the director was ticking off a checklist of style and storytelling tropes, without going the distance of giving us the human connection behind everything. And the impression lingers with Mary and the Witch's Flower, most prominently in that opening sequence. But it does seem that Yonobayashi is gradually edging away from mere slavish replication into something that conveys some form of human grounding. And if you can set aside the overweening clonishness of the production, the film itself stands on its own as a captivating fantasy. Yonobayashi brings a unique look to the wielding of magic, an energetic, bordering on violent visualization that captures a sense of awesome powers at work. And his vision of steampunkish technology has a lot of character to it. Work still needs to be done, though. A late Miyazaki-esque attempt to reform the antagonists feels abrupt and awkward. And one of the attempts to break away from the Ghibli style with the whimsical choreography of a tanuki-like broomstick caretaker feels out of step with the rest of the production, with Miyazaki having once more announced his retirement. And to be honest, the man has retired almost as often as Barbara Streisand. It is kind of nice to feel that the beauty of his style won't completely vanish from the world of animation. Mary and the Witch's Flower demonstrates that if Yonobayashi can somehow bring his own heart into the proceedings, the promise that the Ghibli house style can live on won't be an empty one. And if you happen to be in Philadelphia on January 24th, come join me as we kick off a new film program in the city, Attack of the Classics, bringing great, intense, and sometimes just plain strange movies back to the big screen, where they always belonged. First up will be Dario Argento's horror classic, Suspiria. See it the way it was meant to be seen, cringing in your theater seat. Again, that's on January 24th. Shows at 7 o'clock and 9:30 at the AMC Broad Street 7, at the intersection of North Broad Street and Cecil B. Moore, right across from Temple University. Be there, or be a shape that doesn't possess a pleasant, round outline. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
We're so busy worrying about Facebook over here that we're ignoring the radio, which would not be a first for WBAI in any way, shape, or form. Speaking of which, I didn't say before, and I probably should have, that you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, vibrating at WBAI.org, and profiling, for the moment, at Facebook Live. And the program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. That was a review by Dan Persons, although he did outro himself properly. Before we get started talking to our wonderful guest this morning, Chandler Klang Smith, I need to announce the next Nursef reading. Because, yes, it's already time to start doing that. But I can't do it off the top of my head. I actually have to go to my own website, which for all of you, by the way, is ourwolf.com. And it's a really great website if you are studying what websites looked like in 1995. it very much has that look, although parts of it are up to date. And one of the parts that is up to date is actually the readings part. And it even has the, you know, the videos of the live readings and all that. But yes, our next reading is February 6th, and it is complex enough guests, enough people, more stars than at MGM, so that I actually do have to look at the lineup. Okay, the reading series was begun some 27 years ago by Gordon Van Gelder. He will be the guest curator. Gordon has a new book coming out called Welcome.